If you use the internet, you know we're in the era of sharing everything from family photos to crowdsourced facts. Social observer Jeremy Rifkin calls this sharing the collaborative commons. He says as it grows, we're going to see more than cute kittens and Kickstarter campaign requests online. Rifkin believes we're watching the beginning of the end of the capitalist system as we know it. Jeremy Rifkin's new book is called The Zero Marginal Cost Society. I asked him what he means when he talks about the collaborative commons.
This is a new economic system, the collaborative commons. It's just entering onto the world stage. And what's interesting, this is the first new economic system to emerge since the advent of capitalism and its antagonist socialism in the early 19th century. So this is a remarkable historical event, and it has tremendous long-term implications for all of our lives in the years ahead. The collaborative commons is a completely different way to organize economic life. And the reason it's emerging is something called zero marginal cost. Now, people shouldn't be frightened about this. This is a business
already
term.
My palms sweated already.
It's a business term, but marginal costs are the cost of producing an additional unit of a good or service once you've covered your fixed cost. This zero marginal cost is triggering a vast economic shift in society, and it's because of a paradox. There's a paradox deeply embedded in the heart of the capitalist market that's actually been responsible for its great success over the last two centuries. But the very success of this paradox is now leading to the potential of the capitalist market being replaced by this collaborative commons. In a capitalist market, sellers are always trying to find new technologies to increase their productivity, reduce their marginal costs, so they can put out cheaper products, win over consumers, and bring profits back to their investors. So business people have always welcomed lower marginal costs. They simply never anticipated a technology revolution so steep in its productivity that could actually reduce those marginal costs to near zero, making goods and services actually priceless, free, and beyond the market. And that's actually what's happening. Now, you know, you've seen it in various industries over the last 10 years. The zero marginal cost phenomena invaded the information goods industry. It just tore through the recording industry as millions of consumers became prosumers and began to share their own music with each other. Then it hit the newspaper, magazine, and publishing industry. Again, millions of people became prosumers and started to create their own information and their own video, their own text, their own blogs, and shared it with each other on this collaborative commons, again, at near zero marginal cost. And newspapers have gone out of business. Magazines have bellied up. And I can tell you the book publishing industry has been decimated. So it's been a wild ride in the last 10 years, but economists assumed there'd be a firewall here, that the zero marginal cost would not cross the firewall from information goods to the physical world of energy and manufactured products. That firewall has now been breached.
So what sorts of tangible products as opposed to information, which I suppose is an intangible, although I'd like to think it's tangible from my point of view. But what sorts of tangible goods are we now seeing at zero marginal cost?
Renewable energy in a major way, and now 3D printing of manufactured products. There are now millions and millions of prosumers who are creating their own green electricity with solar panels on their roof, wind turbines on their property. They're creating energy with geothermal heat pumps under their buildings, et cetera. And even though the technologies are still a little pricey, for harvesting these energies, the technologies are on an exponential curve, just like computer chips, which reduce the cost of information goods to near zero marginal cost. It used to cost $60 a watt to produce a solar watt in 1978. It's now 66 cents a watt, and it's going down. But even as you have to pay back the fixed costs of your solar panels or wind turbine, the actual marginal cost of producing the energy is near zero because the sun off your roof is free, the wind off the side of your building is free, the heat underneath your building is free. So we literally have millions and millions now of small businesses, homeowners, especially in Europe where I work, that are actually producing energy at near zero marginal cost. And now 3D printing.
So what you're saying is that at some point, and you believe sometime in the 21st century, what we're going to see is a global economy where it's not about exchanging goods for a profit, a cash profit, but that we're going to be exchanging goods and what we trade in is not a euro or a dollar or whatever other currency exists anymore, but you know, a watt of energy
Well, we'll be trading social currencies, et cetera. It's a big leap forward. You take 3D printing, for example. This just came on the scene 2 years ago. We now have hundreds of thousands of hobbyists and small businesses with these little physical printers, and they are printing out manufactured products using cheap feedstock, and they're powering their little factory with their own green electricity, and then they're sending their products to market with electric vehicles that are powered by their own energy. So what's precipitating this is a technology revolution called the Internet of Things. The Internet is expanding over the last 24 months to include a bigger Internet, the Internet of Things. The communication Internet, which we all are familiar with, is now converging with a very fledgling energy Internet and a nascent logistics and transport Internet to create a single operating platform, kind of a neural system, a brain. And then from this brain, and this is happening now, sensors are being connected across the economic value chain. There are now 14 billion sensors connecting resource flows, factory production lines, warehouses, smart roads, automobiles, homes, offices, feeding big data back to these three internets, communication, energy, and logistics. And by 2020, there will be 50 billion sensors, and by 2030, 100 trillion sensors connecting everything with every being. So what this allows us to do, it allows millions of us who are now exchanging our own information for free to go up on this system, access all the data coming in for nearly free, and then we can increase our productivity, reduce our marginal costs with advanced analytics and our own algorithms. It's not rocket science, and we can produce our own goods and services nearly free, just like we've been doing in the last 15 years with information goods. So that means you have to start thinking about what kind of economic system would you need?
Well, I'm thinking that as you're talking, and I am speaking with Jeremy Rifkin, whose new book is called The Zero Marginal Cost Society. It almost seems like some kind of wild blue sky fantasy. I mean, you're ultimately envisioning a world where this hard currency, cash, that we don't even actually use cash anymore, but that thing that we exchange for goods and for which many people reap dollar profits or euro profits, that isn't going to be the playing field anymore.
No, and it already isn't in a significant way. So this isn't academic. We see the trend lines already. You know, we normally think there's only two ways to organize an economy, either government manages or private enterprise or some combination of both, capitalism, socialism, or social market economy. And we give short shrift to a third alternative. There is an institution that all of us rely on every single day to provide a whole array of goods and services that are not provided by the private market based on profit or government. And that's the social commons, the civil society. It's made up of both nonprofit organizations and informal organizations that attend to the social needs we have, daycare centers for our kids, educational institutions, healthcare services, environmental organizations, cultural, sports, arts. And these institutions are not looked on by economists because they create social capital. They don't create finance capital. But they're a big revenue producer. They're about $2.2 trillion in revenue, and they're growing faster than the private market.
Well, I believe that you were citing, in particular, I believe, in Great Britain and the United States, that the nonprofit sector has grown something like 10% over the recent few years.
Actually, more.
More than that.
It's amazing to me, even. If you take a look between 2000 and 2010, the social commons, the not-for-profit sector, grew at 42% in its revenue. GDP grew at 16% in its revenue. So you see the trend lines. And in many countries like the U.S. and Britain, the nonprofit sector, the social commons, is already over 5% of the GDP and over 10% of the employment and growing while the marketplace is diminishing.
At this point in time, though, at least in the United States, I work in the nonprofit sector. We operate within this structured economy in that the organizations have to, we just finished raising money, so we have to raise this capital to fund ourselves. So we are still under that umbrella. At what point do the two worlds cross paths and that whole idea of needing to raise the capital to fund the nonprofit end? And it just continues to operate in some other kind of way.
This is a pretty crucial point. And, you know, creating social capital doesn't require as much finance capital, but it requires capital. Economists have long argued that the social commons is a parasite because it relies on government grants and private philanthropy. But this is interesting. Johns Hopkins Center for Nonprofit Studies did a survey of 40 countries on nonprofits, and what they found is that this is just a myth, that over 50% of the revenue that comes to these social commons organizations is fees for services rendered, and only 35% is government grants, which is less than the government gives to private enterprise when they contract out. So if there's any parasite here, it's obviously private enterprise that gets more of the government dollars. So this is a somewhat self-financing medium. What I think we're beginning to see already is a hybrid economy, part capitalist market, part collaborative commons. Hundreds of millions of people are already up on that common, sharing their videos, audio, text, blogs, news, and knowledge. And they're now beginning to share their energy, their renewable energy, their 3D printed products. They're even sharing their cars with car sharing services. Young people are sharing homes with Airbnb and couch surfing. They're sharing clothes with ThredUp. They're sharing college courses with massive open online courses. So this is not academic. It's already occurring. We just haven't identified it. So I think my sense is by mid-century, the capitalist market will still be here. It will flourish, but it will flourish as a very powerful niche player, primarily providing network solutions and services and aggregation of those services. And I suspect by mid-century, this collaborative commons, if it isn't derailed, will dominate. However, let me give you two wild cards. Climate change, cyberterrorism could derail this whole shift to a new paradigm. Food may not get cheaper.
Well, that is my one question. As you're listing all the various commodities and goods and services, the one thing that, although I know that there are experiments with 3D printers and food, yeah, but mostly for astronauts in space, and they can't be choosers. They're up there floating around. They have to eat whatever comes their way. But, you know, at this point in time, you know, we've got this whole thing that we need to sustain our bodies. The other thing I wonder about is we've got a gazillion business schools, at least in the United States, cranking out legions of kids who are taught to go forth and maximize profit and make money. I mean, this is not just a shift technologically. It would require, it would seem, a psychological shift in what we want out of the world.
Absolutely. You know, I teach at the Wharton School. It's the oldest business school in the world. And I taught the advanced management program, our premier CEO program, for 15 years. And I still teach there a little bit. And but what we're seeing now in the business schools is we're beginning to have a second curriculum, which is we're beginning to prepare young people for social entrepreneurial enterprises, which some are pro-market, some are nonprofit, some are hybrids between the two. So we have a younger generation who grew up on service learning in high schools. So they got a sort of feel for a different way to be entrepreneurial, because in service learning, you're in nonprofit organizations, you're helping the needs of the community. So they begin to realize there's another way to find value in life, and that is to be employed as social entrepreneurs within the communities to create social capital, not just market capital. And a survey was done of honor students in high schools last year and found that most of them would prefer to work with more intellectually interesting employment in the social commons, where they're creating social capital, not in the financial market, where they're simply creating widgets, you know, for the bottom line. What we're going to see here is a real shift in employment. People say, well, if everything's moving to near zero marginal cost, what about labor? Well, labor is moving to near zero marginal cost labor. We have workerless factories. We have virtual retailing. And now the white-collar industries are being automated, and even the knowledge sector. We don't need all the lawyers, the accountants, the radiologists. We've got analytics and algorithms. So the question is, where do we find employment? This is where you're talking about the narrative shift. In the short to midterm, I think that there is one last surge of mass wage labor, and that is to lay out this infrastructure, this Internet of Things. We've got to transform the whole energy grid to renewable energies quickly. We have to install micro power plants on every building to generate the electricity. We have to put in an energy internet. We have to put in an automated logistics system. So we got about 30 years to lay out the infrastructure. But once that infrastructure is in, it's smart. It's intelligent. It can program itself. So I suspect that we're beginning to see a huge migration of employment to the nonprofit sector. And that's where we're going to find more interesting jobs.
So you're talking like 2050.
I think we're seeing it now. The nonprofit sector is picking up employment much quicker over the last 15 years than the private enterprise. So that's already a done deal. I'd say over the next 30 years, between now and 2050, barring a derailment, this is happening. But let me emphasize, climate change is the elephant in the room here that could mean that all of this potential future is derailed because it's affecting agriculture. And what we're seeing now out here in the western part of the U.S. and around the world is the water cycles changing. What people are not really aware of is the terrifying nature of climate change. It changes the water cycle of the Earth. For every 1 degree that the temperature goes up because of climate change, the atmosphere is absorbing 7% more precipitation. It's throwing off the water cycle, so we're getting very extreme water events, bitter winters, dramatic spring floods, really prolonged summer droughts. This is affecting agricultural yield and water supply. And if we can't deal with climate change, we won't address this. The good news is this third industrial revolution, this Internet of Things, is designed to get us into those renewable energies. I just don't know if we'll make it in time.
I'm talking with Jeremy Rifkin. His book is called The Zero Marginal Cost Society. And as you speak, I can't help but think about China, the emerging global superpower, which when they have the global conferences about climate change, one of China's arguments has been over the past decade or so is, well, that's fine for you guys in the West to say because you've already developed your economies. We're still developing and we should be allowed to sort of go free. And they're talking about money. I mean, it's a country where people are now racking. There is a growing disparity between the rich and the poor, like we're seeing in the first world mm-hmm. nations, and maybe a reluctance to buy into that idea of social capital.
You know, China's been the big surprise for me. As you know, this third industrial revolution, this economic plan that I helped develop for the EU is our formal plan in the European Union, shifting to these renewable energies mm-hmm. and to a more equitable system. But I was a little tough on China, and then I got the biggest surprise of my life. That book, The Third Industrial Revolution, I think we did a show here on that.
Yes.
It came out 2 years ago in China, and it was picked up by the Chinese leadership. There's 400,000 copies in print. It was the best-selling nonfiction book. But what happened in China is the new premier, Premier Li, read the book in English, and he instructed federal agencies to begin moving on this. And so there's a huge conversation in China about moving to a more distributed Internet of Things and a renewable energy future. And it's not just talk. I was there on an official visit in September with the government leadership. We spent 3 weeks. 10 weeks later, the government announced an $82 billion four-year commitment to begin introducing the energy Internet so they could move on an Internet of Things future. By contrast, we're trying to spend $3 billion over 20 years for an energy Internet year.
The other thing I can't help but think about as we talk is that we have seen since 2008 the start of the Great Recession in this country. We sort of moved towards the nonprofit sector because the for-profit sector has stopped rehiring. I don't know whether that's because they're increasingly technologically astute or whether they're greedy and they're concentrating. I mean, some people would argue that they want to concentrate. You know, we are seeing more and more capital concentrated in fewer hands. So that might drive a lot of us to the social commons, to social capital, to nonprofits. But there is still that percentage that has a lot of control of the actual wealth in the society. And I can't imagine that they're necessarily eager to divest themselves of that.
As you know, in the Zero Marginal Cost Society, I spend some torturous time in the book on this question of who's going to control this Internet of Things that allows us to connect
right.
the human race in one neural network. It's exciting and it's frightening at the same time. It has tremendous opportunities, but at what cost? What's interesting is that we have 500 global companies right now, and their revenue equals one-third of the GDP of the world. That's because in the first and second industrial revolutions of the 19th and 20th century, we had to create vertically integrated giant companies because the energies were centralized and the communication was centralized. So the only way you could create an economy of scale and cheaper products, big, huge companies vertically integrated. This Internet of Things wipes that out because the Internet of Things is designed to be distributed, collaborative, and it favors peer-to-peer with millions of small players coming together, SMEs, cooperatives. And when millions of small players come together and produce and share goods and services, it literally wipes out these old dinosaurs. And that's we're seeing this in Germany. Renewable energy, over 25% of the electricity now is green. We're heading to 35%. I've advised the chancellor since she came in. And guess who's producing it? Urban and rural cooperatives made up of people like you and me. And the big power companies have been wiped out in 7 years. So this happened in the recording industry.
Yes.
With file sharing music. It happened in the newspapers. It happened in publishing. It's now happening in energy and within a few years, 3D printing. So I'm guardedly hopeful because I see the trends. On the other hand, we've got big monopolies trying to stop this, and the big thing is they're trying to stop network neutrality. Everyone takes this for granted, but when you go up on the internet, you're not treated any different than anyone else. You have a service provider, you pay a small fee, you go up there, you're not put at the back of the line, you're treated like everyone else. But now the cable and telecom companies are trying to undermine network neutrality. The U.S. Court of Appeals just overrode the Federal Communication Commission on network neutrality because they say, hey, we own the pipes. We want to discriminate. We want to charge more. We want to control the data. And now, may I say this, let's look at Google, Facebook, and Twitter. We love them. I use them every day. But they're now becoming very giant institutions as well. And we want the best of these institutions because they've helped create the social commons. But we got to make sure that they're good players and that nobody is left behind.
Well, in fact, I use them as well. And they were what was going through my head when we were talking about, you know, Global Net, because I don't know yet that Twitter has moved the same direction as Facebook, but Facebook wants to monetize. And so now in people's feeds are not just news and information, but ads that appear the same way. And so as I understand it, that's, you know, they operate within this system is what I'm saying. They operate within a capitalist system. And for some reason, that's the direction they feel that they need to go, as opposed to Wikipedia, which...
Right. Or couch surfing, which is totally nonprofit. Yeah. Well, you know, it's a huge struggle behind the scenes, but it's about to become a big social and political struggle because as hundreds of millions of people become aware of what's happening to them, they're no longer going to take for granted the social commons. What we're seeing is a conflict emerge between traditional capitalist enterprises that are global in scale who want to control this internet thing and keep the margins high.
Right.
Then we have hundreds of millions of people who would like to have a distributed, transparent Internet of Things so they can reduce the marginal cost to near zero and share goods and services. So the real conflict is the monopolization of everything versus the democratization of everything. And somewhere down the middle, we're going to find out where this goes.
The last subject I want to talk about is the banking industry, because Michael Lewis just published a book that kind of ripped open the curtains to day trading and who controls the actual share buying. And what was most interesting about that was the profile of the young Canadian banker who has started essentially what I think of as a social capital type of trading company, even though the aim is to make money. He wants to democratize access to stock purchase. But we have seen, you know, the filthy lucre of the banking industry. We've seen the greed. We've seen the continued insistence by banking executives on making money, on giving themselves huge bonuses. And so we can talk about communications, we can talk about publishing, we can talk about energy. But, you know, right now there's that one industry, at least in this country, that is so powerful and controls so many of the systems, including things like online sharing. That, you know, how does that fit in?
I have a chapter in the Zero Marginal Cost Society on that because it's so pivotal to this. What we're beginning to see on this collaborative commons, the Internet of Things is allowing us to come together and fund our own startups. Crowdfunding is becoming a very big thing where ordinary citizens are just coming together, clustering. And again, when thousands or millions of small players come together with just small amounts of money and cluster startup projects, some of them social enterprises, many of them, it just overwhelms kind of that centralized, vertically integrated financing. Also, social currencies are taking off. There are social currencies now taking all over the world where people on the commons connect up on the Internet of Things and they're sharing their skills and they're not using official currencies. They're using hours. So you can go up and you keep an account of an hour you've given from your skill, and depending on what that skill is worth, you can trade it in for an hour of somebody else's skill. And this is not small potatoes. We're talking about people all over the world who are bypassing official currencies and sharing their skill sets with each other. That's a real revolution. So when you put it all together, all of these individual things that we're seeing emerge seem like they can be absorbed into the traditional capitalist market. But when you put them all together, it smells like a new economic paradigm that's as different from market capitalism as market capitalism was different from feudalism.
I can't help but say that as I read this book, I kept thinking this is a utopian vision. I mean, in some sense, it is a utopian vision. I mean, it's a vision of a society that's not based on the accrual of money. It's based on interactive sharing.
Well, I'll tell you a little story that's interesting. In the height of the Depression in 1930, Keynes, the great economist, wrote a little essay to his grandchildren because people were pretty down at that point. And this essay may turn out to be his most poignant forecast. He said, "I know things look bad, and you're going to hear about a new term called technological unemployment. The fact is that we move into the decades of the 20th century and 21st century, the machines are going to be able to do the heavy lifting at very low marginal cost, and we're going to be liberated from work." He said that may shock people and they may be frightful, but it's good news for the human race because we can now reduce the marginal cost of labor and production, and we can move on to the more important things in life. Instead of spending our whole life in front of a machine, we can engage in creating social capital and transcendence in a meaningful communities. And he said, that's a good thing. So, you know, my feeling is it's possible. And, you know, I'm not a techno-optimist if you've read my books over the years. I'm pretty critical of a lot of stuff. Mm-hmm. But I think it's possible to imagine part of the future I am laying out by 2050. It could be our grandchildren in 2050 will look back on the 20th century with the same repulsion that we have when we look back at serfdom and slavery, because they're going to think, my God, my grandparents in the 20th century toiled in these offices and factories making widgets, and the entire value of their life was their productive output and how much material possessions they could come together with. Our kids in 2050, living on a collaborative commons in an automated world, are going to find that a terrible loss of human value, because they're going to be living a pretty different lifestyle, hopefully.
Just a last question. You have worked for many years at the Wharton School of Business, which, as you mentioned, is the oldest business school in the United States. So when you put this to some of maybe colleagues that are more traditional in their view of capitalism, what's their response?
In my executive ed program, I began asking this question in 1999 when Napster debuted. And I said, here's Napster, and a lot of young people are sharing software, and millions of kids are bypassing the recording industry, and near zero marginal cost they're sharing. And then I started saying, now look at the newspaper industry and the magazine industry and book publishing. So each year I would ask them, do you think the zero marginal cost phenomena will move beyond information goods and invade the rest of the economy, energy, manufacturing, et cetera? And as we moved over a 10-year period, they became convinced, a lot of them, not all of them, that, yes, something fundamental is happening here. We're not sure what it is. But here's the way I would capture it. Our kids are moving from ownership to access. They're moving from markets to networks. They don't want to own a car. They just want to car share and have the mobility when they need it. They're not interested in possessions. They don't define their freedom by how much they have and own and possess. They don't define their freedom by being autonomous islands. That's a capitalist market idea. These millennial kids define their freedom as access and inclusion and embeddedness in networks and in communities. So for them, to be free is to value the network and therefore value themselves. It's a completely different idea of economic activity. And as you say, it creates a new narrative. Where this is going to go, we don't know yet. We're just seeing the outlines of this collaborative commons. Right now, it's side by side with the capitalist market. In 30 or 40 years, it may become the dominant system. I don't think capitalism will disappear, but it may not be the exclusive arbiter of our life by mid-century.
Jeremy Rifkin, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.